This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith, and our guest today is Dean Michael Zimmerman by phone from Butler University.
Okay.
Hello, Dean Zimmerman. Can you hear me all right? We're having a few technical difficulties here this afternoon. Can you hear me?
Okay, so we're having a hard time getting Dean Zimmerman on the phone, but I just wanted to say, Steve, that I found a website that I think is really neat that I would like to share with our listeners, and that is the Complete Works of Charles Darwin Online. And it's a website that has 20,000 private papers and manuscripts and all of his writings, and that is at darwin-online.org.uk. And it also has obituaries and reviews and an audio Darwin series, which is it has Darwin's Beagle Diary read by Joan Stone Viewings. And so that's a pretty cool resource for people to use to get to read some rare manuscripts and writings by him that were only available to the academia before. So anyone can go to the website. And once again, that's darwin-online.org.uk.
And we are going to be talking, as soon as we solve some of the technical problems here at the studio, with Dean Michael Zimmerman, who is the dean of LAS, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. He's a biologist himself, and he's organized something called Evolution Weekend, which is this weekend, and various rabbis and priests and ministers all over the country have, in about 1,000 congregations, have agreed to deliver a homily, a talk, a lecture, a sermon on the fact that evolution and religious faith can coexist together, you don't have to give up on one to use the other. So we're still trying to solve problems here with the technical issues. Our earphones have the delay, and so
we have some new technology that we're really excited about, but we haven't quite figured out all the kinks to that. And of course, this is the 200th anniversary of Darwin's writings, and so that's why you've seen so many things in the news and in the media about Darwin lately.
Darwin and with the issue of evolution. And Dean Zimmerman, if you're on the phone and can hear us, we're trying to get so that we can hear you in real time as opposed to a delay, and it looks like we've solved that problem. Can you hear us, Dean Zimmerman?
Yes, I can.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we've solved that issue. Great. I don't know if you heard me introduce you, but I mentioned that you were a biologist. And
that's where I picked up.
And dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Butler. Now, how long have you been in that position?
This is my third year here in Indianapolis.
And you came to Butler from where?
I was dean for 14 years at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. And before that, I spent 12 years at Oberlin College as a biologist
Oberlin.
And an administrator.
Ah, wonderful. And where did this idea come from to get clergy of various faiths, Jewish and Christian and maybe even Muslim, others, to celebrate evolution?
Well, it started, in a sense, back in the 80s. That is, in the 80s, I was involved in the creation evolution controversy quite a bit, writing and speaking on the topic. And regularly, people would come to me and ask if I would come to their town and address the school board because there was an issue going on. And I would always say, sure, I can come, or I can get you another scientist to come who might be more articulate than I am, but you don't want either of us. What you want is, first and foremost, somebody local instead of somebody from out of town. And then secondly, you don't even want a scientist, you want a minister. Because the issue that people are trying to create, they're manufacturing a controversy. The issue is not really one between science and religion as much as it is between different religious worldviews. And if you have a local minister, it just carries so much more weight and reframes the question dramatically. So back in 2004, when a small town in Wisconsin asked for help, I knew what I really needed to do. I got a whole lot of scientists on board to try to get the school board to do what they need to do, the right thing, and overturn a really crazy creationist motion that they had passed. And we succeeded. But really what we needed to do was get clergy involved, because clergy help reshape the debate. And that's when the clergy letter got started, back in late 2004.
So tell us the actual title of this project.
The actual title is the Clergy Letter Project. It started with one clergy letter, that is a letter written by a UCC minister, a friend of mine by the name of Reverend John McFadden. And it was specifically for Christian clergy members in the United States. Since then, we've expanded. We have, since this last summer, a rabbi letter, and we have a Unitarian Universalist clergy letter. And then back in 2005, we started this holiday, at that point called Evolution Sunday. We expanded 2 years ago to be Evolution Weekend, to be more inclusive. And, you know, from the very beginning, we chose this to be the Sunday closest to Darwin's birth, and we know it worked because the Postal Service on that Sunday did not deliver mail to any homes in the country.
Now, when you started having this weekend included Jewish rabbis, how fast did that grow, and what number are you up to? I said you had about a total of close to 1,000 the last I heard.
Yeah, and you also said from all parts of the country, and I want to correct that. I want to extend that. We're, in fact, in all parts of the world. We've been growing at about 30% a year, and if you think about that, if the U.S. economy was growing at 30% positively now, not negatively, we would be doing something pretty dramatic.
Wouldn't we all be happy?
Oh, you know it. Well, it depends how our carbon footprint was while we did that, though.
True.
But literally, we've been growing at about 30% a year. This year, as of my last count, we have 1,034 congregations, and 15 different countries are represented. I believe every continent has been represented except for Antarctica. So we really are extending our reach and demonstrating it through so many different congregations and denominations and religions that religion and science are not at odds with one another, and that, as I said, the fight is a manufactured one.
A local professor here at the University of Illinois, as you know, where this program originates, although it's heard throughout the Midwest and online around the world too, but a local professor, Professor Barenbaum, May Barenbaum.
Sure, an entomologist, a wonderful entomologist, member of the National Academy of Science.
Yes, he is. She said just this week that As a biologist, she does not worship Darwin or regard his work as a holy text, and so she objects to the word Darwinism as if it were a faith. Do you have that same reaction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to respect Darwin. We need to celebrate all that he has accomplished. But it's really funny. When I get into debates with creationists, they say, but this part of what Darwin said was wrong. And, of course, lots of things that he said was wrong because he knew so little about modern biology. When he formulated his ideas on evolution, we had no concept of genes and alleles and chromosomes. We had no idea of particulate inheritance as we do now. Science is so different from faith and from fundamentalism, in that there is no text we revere and there's no person we revere. We respect lots of things. But as new ideas come into play, ideas change, and our theories, our hypotheses develop, and occasionally one theory replaces another. The whole concept and the use of the term Darwinism implies, just as Dr. Barenbaum said, a fixity of ideas, just like the King James Version of the Bible. And in science, that just doesn't happen. I mean, she's right on target.
Let me take a moment, since we had such confusion at the beginning of the show, to reintroduce our guest today. My intern, Carly Nix, who is here, a recent graduate of Boston University in Religion, and whose voice you heard earlier. She and I are in the studio in Urbana, here. here at the WILL AM 580, and we're talking by phone with Dean Michael Zimmerman of Butler University. Dean Zimmerman is a biologist and head of, are you the director of the Clergy Letter Project? Is this, is there a title? Are you a nonprofit organization? What exactly, what should I say?
We've never bothered to become incorporated in any way.
Okay.
So I call us a grassroots organic consortium. Given that there's only one non-paid employee and no paid employees, any title you want, I'll take.
So there isn't a board that's helped you do this. You've literally done it yourself.
I've done it myself. Having said that, We have over 13,000 members, and they find other members, and they, it's the clergy themselves who step into the pulpit and use their churches to do interesting things. It's the scientists, and we have over 600 of them from 29 different countries on our scientists page, our list of consultants who consult with clergy. What I do, I help get people on board. I help publicize our efforts, and literally, I manage the web page. But it could not have happened without 13,000 other people.
And when you say those people are members, now membership doesn't require any money.
Not a penny.
What does it take?
It takes either if you're a scientist and you join our list of scientific consultants and put your name and information up on our webpage, automatically you become a member. If you're a clergy member and you sign one of our three clergy letters, you become a member. If you are out of the country, since our clergy letters are for U.S. citizens, clergy members who are U.S. citizens, or clergy members who happen to be working in the United States, if you're a clergy member out of the country and you participate in Evolution Weekend, you're a member. And frankly, if you're a clergy member outside of the country and are unable for whatever reason to participate in Evolution Weekend, but you care, you're a member. And if you're not a member, but you just care, you're on our mailing list. Since we have no rules, it's easy to be a member.
And if there are listeners who are clergy of any faith?
Any faith whatsoever. Well, any faith whatsoever can participate in Evolution Weekend. The only people right now who can sign one of our three clergy letters are Christian clergy, Unitarian Universalists, and rabbis. If one of your listeners is of a different religion and they want to organize a similar letter for that religion, I would love to speak with them.
So Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, whoever who would be
Absolutely.
Amenable to this, how may they then contact you? What information would you like to give out over the air?
Let me give out two pieces of information. First, anybody can go to our website, which is a very easy web address. It's just www.theclergyletterproject.org. theclergyletterproject.org, or they can just write to me at care of Butler University. My email is very simple. It's just my initials, mz@butler.edu. And if you are a clergy member and you want to sign up, if you want to sign on to one of our clergy letters, just drop me a note and tell me that, and I'll get back to you pretty quickly.
Very good. Carly Nix and I, as I say, are in the studio, and I think we've solved the technical problems to the place. We can now give out the phone numbers for callers. So let me do that. If listeners would like to call in and ask a question to Dean Zimmerman about the Clergy Letter Project, about Evolution Weekend, about science and faith in relation to evolution, do give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, you may use a toll-free number. That's 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. If you're in Champaign Urbana, there are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. So Champaign Urbana, 333-9455. And we'll get you on the air with your question or comment. We are always eager for conversation. Carly.
And I have a question. You said that this dilemma between creationism and evolutionary theory is a manufactured fight. And what did you mean by that?
That's a good question. What really is happening is that there is one relatively narrow sect, one group of Christians, fundamentalists, some narrow evangelicals, who have defined their religion in such a way that it conflicts with evolution. What they're working very hard to do, they're the most outspoken group. They have been the ones for the last 20 years, basically, who get most press. What they've done is try to hijack religion and say that they are the norm. Their religious views are the norm. And then they go further and they say, because our religious views are the norm, our religious views should be taught in public schools. And in fact, the mere presence of the clergy letter itself, signed by, as of right now, about 11,851, 52 Christian clergy, the mere presence of that letter says that you can be a Christian clergy member and not have a problem between religion and science or between religion and evolution. So the fight is between one religious group and all of the other religious groups. It has nothing to do with science at all. It has to do with a very narrow religious worldview. Now, the goal of the Clergy Letter Project is not to convince fundamentalists they should give up their religion. We live in a pluralistic society. We ought to respect people of all religions, but we need, while we respect people of all religions, for them to respect others. And when that religious view, just one narrow religious view, is passed off as the norm, and the people who sign the clergy letter are attacked for not being good Christians, or not being Christians at all, or not being religious at all, we're not seeing appropriate respect. We have great diversity of religion in this country and in the world, and they all deserve to be able to, all the proponents of each deserve to be able to practice their faith.
Could we hear the letter? Do you have copies of say, the Christian letter in front of you that our listeners could listen to?
Sure.
About 11,000, so many clergy have signed on to.
Yeah, as of 10 minutes ago, I added the last one. It's actually 11,853 signatures on the Christian clergy letter. It's two paragraphs long, and if you like, I'll read both paragraphs.
Please do.
Within the community of Christian believers, there are areas of dispute and disagreement, including the proper way to interpret Holy Scripture. While virtually all Christians take the Bible seriously and hold it to be authoritative in matters of faith and practice, the overwhelming majority do not read the Bible literally as they would a science textbook. Many of the beloved stories found in the Bible, the creation, Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, convey timeless truths about God, human beings, and the proper relationship between creator and creation, expressed in the only form capable of transmitting these truths from generation to generation. Religious truth is of a different order from scientific truth. Its purpose is not to convey scientific information, but to transform hearts. We, the undersigned Christian clergy, from many different traditions, believe that the timeless truths of the Bible and the discoveries of modern science may comfortably coexist. We believe that the theory of evolution is a foundational scientific truth, one that has stood up to rigorous scrutiny and upon which much of human knowledge and achievement rests. To reject this truth, or to treat it as one theory among others, is to deliberately embrace scientific ignorance and transmit such ignorance to our children. We believe that among God's good gifts are human minds capable of critical thought, and that the failure to employ this gift is a rejection of the will of our Creator. To argue that God's loving plan of salvation for humanity precludes the full employment of the God-given faculty of reason is to attempt to limit God, an act of hubris. We urge school board members to preserve the integrity of the science curriculum by affirming the teaching of the theory of evolution as a core component of human knowledge. We ask that science remain science and that religion remain religion, two very different but complementary forms of truth.
We've just heard read of the letter from the Clergy Letter Project by Dean Michael Zimmerman for Christians, and there's a similar letter for Jewish rabbis who've signed. How many Jewish rabbis do you have? I should be able to subtract that, but I'm
no,
nervous.
There's no easy way to tell. It's 448.
Okay.
And similarly, our UU clergy letter has 191 as of 10 minutes ago.
Okay. Unitarian Universalist. All
exactly.
Right. Now, you told us how the Christian letter first got produced. Did it get? Did more than one person participate in the final wording?
It was actually written by a friend of mine who's a UCC,
United Church of Christ,
sorry, yes. Minister in Wisconsin. And he asked a couple of friends of his for help with some wording. It's kind of funny, he just posted a blog for Evolution Weekend about 3, 4, 5 days ago. And he said, you know, had he realized how widespread this letter was going to go? Because when he wrote it, it was just for people in Wisconsin. It was for a particular fight with a particular school board.
Sure.
He said, he would have spent a little more time crafting it. But
well, it still reads pretty well, I think.
I think it's beautiful. And it's so nice that I had nothing to do with the creation of it, other than asking, I asked for something to be written, that I can sit here and say what a wonderful job it is without tooting my own horn, because he wrote it, and there's beauty in some of those words.
Now, do you happen to be a person of faith yourself?
Funny, that question almost always comes up. It's come up for about 30 years when I've been doing...
You may choose not to answer, of course.
No, I'm happy to answer it, but what's interesting is it's as if my faith matters in terms of this issue. And in terms of the Clergy Letter Project, I am a conduit. I am helping to organize the works of others and bring people together. But personally, no, I am not a person of faith.
Now, the Clergy Letter Project, it deals with evolution. You talked about evolution being a foundational scientific truth. Now, what does that mean?
Well, it goes back to, or the best way to explain it, I guess, goes back to 1973 when the great population geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky wrote an article in a thing called American Biology Teacher. And the article was entitled, "Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution." And that title, it was a great article beyond that title, but that title says it all. What evolution does within the construct of biology, and then we can go beyond biology if you like, it provides a context. It provides a framework that all of biology can hang itself on. If you do away with the theory of evolution, what you end up having are random facts, random observations that don't come together. Teaching biology without the theory of evolution is like teaching history by just asking students to memorize random dates. There's nothing that ties it all together. And when you go to the creationist literature and you see the attacks upon evolution, the implications are that biology is wrong, but beyond that, it means most of or all of astronomy is wrong, most of physics is wrong, virtually all of chemistry and anthropology and linguistics are wrong.
And we haven't even got to paleontology.
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy stuff. So evolution as we understand it today, and as we understand it today, as May Birenbaum said when you mentioned it earlier, is quite a bit different than we understood it in 1859. And as we understand evolutionary theory tomorrow and 10 years from now, it will be slightly different than it is today. And that's what's so exciting about science in general and evolution in particular. It is changing and growing and maturing. It's not static, but it certainly has not been proven incorrect, and there's no better theory out there. If a better theory were to arise, I assure you scientists would embrace it.
Now, for people outside of the field of biology and some others that use evolution theory, a lot of people don't understand, and I guess I would have to be one of them. I took a few biology courses in college, and I've gone to some conferences of microbiology because my wife's a microbiologist, but frankly, I don't understand it really well, and I know a lot of lay people, when I've brought this up in churches, really are talking about Lamarckism as they try to understand how this works. And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. Although it's hard in 2-3 minutes to get a full course on biology.
Of course.
But the simple aspect is there are hereditary units. Everybody understands roughly what genes are. Genes come in various forms. You get one form from each parent. So there are two versions of each gene, and those things are called alleles. And the simple definition of evolution is a change in allele frequency in a population over time. So as an individual reproduces, its offspring have half of its genetic component from one parent, half of its genetic component from the second parent, and the composition of each allele in a population changes. Because the environment can provide strong influences on genetics, that is, some alleles are better adapted, some alleles help an organism survive better, reproduce better, feed better, do whatever, than others, those alleles end up increasing in frequency. Other alleles end up decreasing in frequency. That, very simply, that's what natural selection is all about. Now, one of the interesting things is natural selection is just one mechanism of a number of evolutionary mechanisms. Alleles change in populations because of a whole bunch of different things. And one of the challenges of evolutionary biologists is to try to figure out under what circumstances is each of those evolutionary mechanisms predominant. So when does natural selection play a bigger role than random drift? Or when does migration play a bigger role than founder effect, small population size? So there are a whole bunch of different issues, but the basic understanding is that genes, alleles, influence phenotype, that is, behavior and the appearance of organisms, and there's a feedback loop that will allow those alleles that are leading to the best fit with the environment to reproduce the most. Hope that made some sense.
It did, a little. I appreciate it. How about you, Carly? Were you keeping up?
Yes, well, I actually took a class on the history of natural science in high school and a class on the evolution of humans in college, so I've had a little bit of evolution, and I think that my generation is starting to get it more and more. So,
good.
Appreciate that. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment for our guest and for our other listeners. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana is the local number. If you're outside of Champaign-Urbana, there's a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, and that includes people who are listening on the Internet. And incidentally, if you tuned in late or tuned out for a while until we solved our technical problems, you can always go to the WILL website, will.illinois.edu, and go to AM and then check on Keeping the Faith. And you can, in the search engine, put in Zimmerman or Evolution Weekend, and the show will pop up, and you can listen to this at your convenience at your computer. So that's will.illinois.edu, AM, and then Keeping the Faith. And from this date of this program, it's being broadcast live on the 15th of February here in 2009. So do give us a call if you're listening live now, and if you want to listen to the whole program later via computer, that's how to do it. We're about halfway through our program, and let me just take a moment to say that next week we'll be talking with Robert Jones on March 8th with Juan Cole, March 15th with Professor Mohammed Khalil, March 22, Ralph Martire. So these are some of the guests coming up. Oh, I skipped. I'm sorry. Robert Jones is March 1st. Next week, our guest was to be Jerry Sturmer, but as people who have kept up with Illinois news know, he's moved from being director of Voices for Illinois Children to being the chief of staff for our new governor here in Illinois. And so we have a substitute for Jerry Sturmer. It would have been fun to talk to the new chief of staff, but there's so many problems in our state, we understand why he needed to beg off from being on this show. But Sean Noble, who's the also with Voices for Illinois Children, will be on the air next week talking about children's issues in this state. And, of course, people listening in Indiana, there are many parallel problems there. Support for Keeping the Faith is provided in part by the University YMCA here at Champaign-Urbana. And at the Y this coming Tuesday, February 17, Rocky Moffat, a percussionist, and some members of a band. We'll be giving a preview of Day of the Drum, which will be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts on February 24th. But this Tuesday, February 17 at noon, they'll be at the University Y. So that should be fun to talk to a percussionist, a musician, about that program. That's Tuesday at noon, a free demonstration and lecture, and time for question and answers at the University Y. Friday Forum at the Y is February 20. The speaker will be Professor Clark Bullard from Mechanical Sciences and Engineering, talking about clean energy, the fact that it's costly and who should pay for it. That's Professor Clark Bullard, February 20, noon at the Y. I attended the lecture last Friday with David Ruzick, talking about myths of nuclear power, and it was a packed house, over 200 folks there, but it was a great discussion. So, at the Y, that's 1001 South Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall on campus, easily accessible by public transportation, buses. Come right to the Y, right to that corner from all over town. So, those programs are free. If you'd like lunch, give the Y a call, 337-1500. Otherwise, you can bring your lunch or simply come to hear the free program. Well, let's get back to our guest today. Carly Nix and I are in the studio, and we are eager to have folks call in, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit about who some of the folks are who object. You talked about it being narrow evangelicals and Christian fundamentalists. Are there really no Jewish folks who might be more believers in a literal translation of the Hebrew Scriptures about creation?
You know, that's a great question. I was at an Evolution Weekend event Friday night, in fact, in Indianapolis, and we were having that discussion because the author of the Rabbi letter made it clear to me that it wasn't worth trying to get Orthodox rabbis to sign on, because they just wouldn't. Uh-huh. The rabbi that I was with Friday night said no, that he disagrees completely. He thinks that virtually all Orthodox rabbis probably would, they may not be willing to sign on, but they certainly would feel comfortable with an evolutionary worldview. That the Torah, the Old Testament, is not the word of God in the way that it needs to be taken literally. So I'm ignorant. I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but it is a great question.
Well, let's see if some of our listeners might call in and enlighten both of us. We have a caller waiting. Let's go to line number 1. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Can you hear me?
Yes,
go ahead with your comment.
Actually, it was more of a question. When talking about evolution, I heard or read an article about some study that found a fusion of genes or something like that, and I was wondering if you guys had heard something about that and it being particularly sort of a smoking gun in terms of evolution.
By smoking gun, what do you mean, caller?
Well, I'd heard that that the fusion of these genes sort of proved that along the lines between the Neanderthals and Homo sapiens that this had proven or we had evolved.
Okay, let's let our biologists respond. Could you hear that, Dean Zimmerman?
Unfortunately, I could. And by that, I don't mean that the questioner asked a bad question. He just asked it of a bad person. I don't have a clue how to answer that other than to say, we don't need a smoking gun for observing evolution, because we can go into the laboratory, we can go into the field, and scientists do it every day, and see a change in allele frequencies. That's the definition of evolution. We see it every day. In terms of the relationship between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, we are now pretty convinced that we didn't, if you will, evolve from them. We were separate species to begin with, and we shared, I think people are pretty confident, a huge amount of DNA and gene structure, but the wording that the caller used of a fusion of genes, I'm just either unaware of that study or I'm just ignorant. So I can't answer it any more fully than that.
And is it fair to say that would be the people who study that the most would be people in a more specified field than yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an ecologist.
Right, okay.
Yeah, if you want to know about bumblebee foraging patterns, I'm your guy.
Okay.
Well. But that question and the nature of the questions that arise when you talk about evolution generally is exactly why we started the list of scientific consultants for the Clergy Letter Project. And as I mentioned earlier, that list is over 600, it's about 630 scientists who have signed up from 29 different countries. They all are listed on our website. They all have specific expertise after their names and contact information. So when we started this project, clergy members would call me or write me and ask questions that I couldn't possibly answer. And I also didn't possibly have enough time to answer all of the questions. So we started a list of people who were willing to answer questions. So if you go to the website, you can look by zip code, you can look by country, you can look by area of expertise, and find the right person to ask the right question to instead of asking a poor ecologist questions that are so far from his field, he sounds like a fool.
And then the just to repeat the website, it's the Clergy Letterproject.org, and
exactly.
There you can find the list of scientific consultants that maybe could answer that question. Thank you very much, caller, for that. Let's go to a caller on line number four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, line number four.
Hi, this is Bev, and I wanted to make two points. And one was that there's not just one story of creation in the Bible, but there are two, one in Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2. And they are not compatible.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you read more deeply, and I'm out of my league here as well, there are probably five different creation stories.
Oh, right.
If you go a little bit further, but just Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, you're absolutely right. They tell a different order and they tell a different process. It just doesn't make any sense that you can read the two and say, yeah, I can believe both of those literally.
Right. Right. The other point is that the Bible shouldn't be used to evaluate science because we've been wrong about Galileo and solar systems and all kinds of things.
Bev, you're absolutely right. And to assume that the Bible is a scientific text, I think the clergy members who have signed the clergy letters believe that to do that diminishes the importance of the Bible. It takes away the moral lessons. It takes away the metaphor, the poetry, the allegory. People have asked for years what separates animals from humans, and originally we thought it was tool making or something like that, and we discovered lots of animals make tools. We thought it was communication, and lots of animals now communicate, some in a fairly sophisticated way. What it might be is the use of metaphor. And if that's the case, let's celebrate the metaphor in the Bible as something that really makes us truly human and use it in a way that teaches lessons that are transmitted, as the clergy letter says, from generation to generation.
Right. Values and morals and dreams and visions.
Yeah, isn't that so important? And isn't that more important than looking to a text that's thousands of years old for science?
Right.
We have better ways of finding science. We may not have better ways of finding moral values.
Right.
But since we have both of you on the phone at the moment, and since Carly and I are in the field of religion as opposed to science, let me ask you one of those questions about values. One of the lessons that I get when I read those two stories in Genesis is that humans made a big mistake in whenever they began and however they began, by not being grateful to what Christian believers believe is a God that got things started, that is helping things continue on, is involved in life still. And for people who have no faith in a divine being, I guess my question is, isn't there still a clash of values? I don't take those Genesis stories literally, but I do take them as showing that it's a mistake not to be grateful.
I would see those stories, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, mainly as stories about God, how God is all-powerful. Day 1 does this, day 2, and it's all good. And Genesis 2, a God that's down and dirty, breathing into nostrils, etc. So I see it more as a portrait of God, two different portraits of God.
Okay. What about you, Dean Zimmerman? Do you see the issue I'm raising in terms of value?
Yeah, I think so, and I think I can sit here and comfortably agree with what both of you are saying.
Okay.
What confused me, though, Steve, is you said people who don't have a faith. I think what you said, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth.
No.
People who don't have a faith tradition might not have those values, and I'm not sure what that means.
Well, in terms of for people who think there's some sort of a divinity that's, as I say, started the process of life and has helped undergirding it, they think the lack of gratitude is a problem. And what do people who don't have any faith tradition and yet who believe strongly in evolution, do you have to believe, for example, in progress?
Well, a couple things. Evolution and progress are not necessarily the same thing.
Okay.
In that an early view of evolution was that it was directional, and we
right.
now know that it certainly isn't.
Okay.
But more than that, it's true that there are people in this world who are atheists and agnostics. Some of them, but probably not all of them, understand and accept evolution. Those who are atheists and agnostics often see great beauty and wonder in the world. They appreciate the world for what it is and however it came to be. And they, as much as anybody else, can value and want to protect it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Great. Well, caller, thank you very much for your call. And did you have any other follow-ups?
No. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate your call. Let me give the numbers again for others. 1-800-222-9455, anywhere the program is heard. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Dean Zimmerman, does your university approve of your doing this? Because here at this university, it's rather secular, and I'm not sure deans could be patted on the back for working this closely with religious folks.
Well, this is the second university that I've been at while I've been promoting the Clergy Letter Project. I want to say two things. First, although our website is hosted by Butler University, Butler is not a sponsor of the Clergy Letter Project. We are distinct from Butler.
Yes.
Just as when I was at a state institution, the state institution's website hosted our efforts, but they were not a sponsor of the Clergy Letter Project. In both cases, both institutions, one private and one public, the institution recognizes that high-quality science education is important for society. They recognize that in my job as a dean of a school of higher education, especially as a scientist, promoting high-quality science education should be a part of my job. The best way, I think, to promote high-quality science education is to confront head-on the major attack on high-quality science education. That attack is coming from those who believe in either creation science or intelligent design or any of those pieces where they're trying to undermine the science curriculum. As I said at the outset, bringing clergy into the mix is the best thing we can do to promote high-quality science education. Turns out it's also a good thing for religion. So I'm delighted to say the people above me, the people who organize who are in charge of both institutions where I've worked since the Clergy Letter Project has come into being, have been fully supportive and recognize this is exactly the kind of outreach that they should support and I should be doing. But it's a great question.
We have another caller on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with Dean Michael Zimmerman. Go ahead.
Yes. So you have indicated earlier that religious truth and scientific truth are of a different order, and I just wanted to ask the question, do you see any point of intersection where those two orders of truth might intersect to the detriment of science or religion? In other words, how do they inform each other? Clearly, your point is well taken with regard to creationism, but I'm wondering about other implications, for example, of Darwinian theory as it continues to develop, for example, evolutionary psychology and stem cell research and so on. Do you see where places where those two orders of truth can collide and one can affect the other in significant ways? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you for the call.
Good question. From one perspective, no, I don't think there can be any conflict in that what scientists are trying to do is understand the materialistic explanations for the natural world. They're trying to understand how the world works. That's not a religion. There's nothing religious about those issues. If you have good faith, if you care about the world around you, there's nothing a scientist should be able to find that will shake your faith, that will make you throw out good science. Where the intersection comes to be, the caller mentioned stem cell research. It's not on how stem cells work. It's the politics of, should we do that research? Should we undertake stem cell research is not a scientific question. It's a political question. In some people's mind, it's a moral question. Scientists have the right to weigh in on that debate, but they don't have the right to be the final arbiter of that debate. Whether we do that or not, stem cells will work the way they're designed to work, and I use that word advisedly, designed. The question is, will we understand how they work? The implications of science are truly political, and we need to make sure we understand where the science ends and the politics begins. Steve, you had asked earlier why people, or you had said something about people who are upset with evolution, where are they coming from, or something along those lines. And there's another piece of why people get upset. One of those pieces, I think, is back in the 1800s, Herbert Spencer coined the phrase survival of the fittest, and he created social Darwinism. And what social Darwinism did, and this really does get to the caller's question,
yes,
too,
it does.
I believe.
Yeah.
What social Darwinism does is takes evolutionary theory, turns it into a political theory, and then allows us to draw conclusions about how we as humans should operate in the political sphere. There are a lot of people. William Jennings Bryan was one of the great examples when he was fighting the Scopes trial. He was a liberal for quite a while in his life, maybe all of his life, but he hated evolutionary theory because he didn't like the social implications that he saw. It was holding the poor down, and it was concentrating money in the hands of the wealthy. If you don't like that, what we all need to recognize is it's not the underlying evolutionary theory that's amiss. It's the translation of a perfectly good biological theory to a terrible political theory. And if the political theory is really terrible, we ought to throw it out. But you don't throw it out by trashing the underlying scientific theory that happens to be perfectly sound. It's the translation that's bad. And you don't, you know, when you translate one text to another, and if the translator gets it all wrong, it doesn't mean the original text was a mess. And that's where science and religion and science and politics come into conflict, I think.
Now, as a biologist who does research, you say you see this, you see examples of evolution every day. Can you give us an example from your field? You talked about you knowing about bumblebees. I'm not asking you to solve the dying hive problem, but
Those are honeybees.
Oh, is that honeybees?
And I'm a specialist. I know nothing about honeybees, but I know a little bit about bumblebees.
Okay. So give us an example, if you would, of where do you see evolution just daily?
Sure. Let me give you a really interesting. Well, it's probably interesting to nobody but me, but an interesting situation. The flowers, the plants that I've spent most of my life studying, are really interesting in that they have two problems. They produce flowers and they have to attract bumblebees so they can set seed. Bumblebees come, they collect nectar, they move around, and as they move around, they transmit pollen from one flower to another. At the same time, those flowers attract predators. They attract insects, small flies that lay eggs on those flowers. And if they're too attractive to these predators, it's easier for these flies to find them and lay eggs. If they're not attractive enough to bumblebees, they're not going to be sending their pollen around. Now, very specifically, these flies have done a really creative thing. If there are two eggs that are laid on the same flower and they both hatch, they're both competing for seeds that are developing, and there's not enough resources for both of them. And most likely, it's more likely that both of those eggs are going to not successfully turn into adult flies because they will starve. So what the females have done is when they lay down an egg, they glue it to the flower so it stays there and it can hatch. But they also put down what's called an oviposition deterring pheromone, and that is it's a chemical that other females who come around looking for a place to lay eggs can sense and realize, oh, wait, there's an egg here. I'm not going to go here. I'm going to go to another flower that's not been used yet. And the reason for that is a very strong selection pressure to make sure your offspring have enough resources to survive. From another perspective, then I'll stop, I study plant behavior. How do plants know how much nectar to produce? We've done lots of experiments, my students and I, over the years. If you increase nectar production, the pollinators that come, the bumblebees that come, don't move around very much. And they end up moving pollen, but they move it within one plant, and that's not very healthy. So if they produce less nectar, bumblebees have to leave, and they move pollen further. But if they don't produce enough nectar, no one's going to come to bother at all. So there are these conflicting pressures regularly, and the question is, which alleles, which genes are going to be favored by reproducing the most?
Fascinating.
As I said, I'm the only one who's interested in this stuff. was overwhelming.
But that gives us a very practical example, and thank you for doing that.
Sure.
We're talking with Dean Michael Zimmerman, who is head, I think we'll just make up that title, head of the Clergy Letter Project, where many rabbis and priests, ministers, Christian priests and ministers have signed on to these various letters which affirm evolution and also affirm their religious faith and point out that there is no reason the two should be at odds. And there are now up to 13,000 folks who've signed on to these various letters, and also Unitarian Universalists have a separate letter. And you can learn more about this online at theclergyletterproject.org. And Dean Zimmerman has given his email if you want to directly contact him, perhaps find out more about it, mz@butler.edu. Dean Zimmerman is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Butler. Tell us a little bit about Butler. How big a school is it?
Butler's an institution with about 4,000 students. We have five different colleges: College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, a pharmacy school, business school, College of Education, and the Jordan College of Fine Arts.
Located
in Indianapolis, Indiana, and as of today, we lost today, so I'm worried about tomorrow. We have the 15th ranked men's basketball team in the country.
Well, Illinois may meet you in the NCAA. We'll see. Tell us the background of the school. It's a private school. Is it related to any religious group at its beginning?
At its beginning, yes, it was. We were founded by Disciples of Christ, and we split from them probably about 50 years ago, I think. Down the street from us is the Christian Theological Seminary, which was a spinoff from Butler, in a sense, quite a while back. And the home of the national home of the Disciples of Christ is in Indianapolis, just basically down the block from us.
And Christian Theological Seminary is a noted seminary for theological education. We've had professors from there, guests on Keeping the Faith, and I'm sure some of them have signed on to your Clergy Letter Project.
Yes, they have.
And I should confess that although I'm not pastor of a congregation right now, as a Presbyterian minister, I was intrigued by this and happy to sign on to add my name to the list as well. And although I've not had a congregation to report on, I have had this program and have had some professors here at this university in previous years on this weekend talking about their particular faith and in relation to their also use of evolution. Carly, you had a comment.
Yes, I was just wondering, what are some of the events that you had planned for the Evolution Weekend or Evolution Sunday over the years?
What's really nice is that the way Evolution Weekend is structured is that each local congregation anywhere in the world that wants to participate does what it thinks makes the most sense for itself. And there's nothing centralized, and there's no central structure. So lots of congregations have listened to sermons, and on our webpage we have almost 200 of those sermons posted right now. Other congregations have watched some really interesting DVDs. Many congregations have brought in scientists, often scientists of faith, who have written interesting books about how they reconcile the two. So they've brought in those people to talk and have had discussions. We've had some of our congregations have had children's Bible class. Some have had adult Sunday classes. Some just have had lunchtime discussions. One congregation, I think either they just did or this coming week, Wednesday, I've lost track of the date, is staging a version of Inherit the Wind and having dinner. So they're creating a dinner theater for themselves with Inherit the Wind. Congregation in Colorado created a large maze, I think it was outside of their sanctuary, and as you walk through the maze, you go through a timeline of evolution. So there have been just a host of different things that are really kind of fascinating, but the important thing is that we're trying real hard to elevate the quality of the dialogue. What people started by saying, especially around the time of Dover, is if you accept evolution, you're going to hell. That's not meaningful dialogue. What we're trying to do is get people to understand that you can talk about religion and science in the same breath, and you can do both. You can accept both.
We're going to have to stop. We've run out of time, but I want to thank our callers and particularly our guest from Butler University, the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, Michael Zimmerman, head of the Clergy Letter Project. Thanks also to Carly Nix, our intern, who's been in the studio with us today and who will be hosting some of these programs in the weeks to come. I remind you that next week our guest will be Sean Noble. He's sitting in for Jerry Sturmer, who's been just given the new job of chief of staff for our governor here in Illinois. Sean Noble is from the Voices for Illinois Children. That'll be next week here on AM 580, Keeping the Faith. Remind people in the local area that at the University Y this February 17, Tuesday, Day of the Drum, and on Friday, Clean Energy is Costly, Who Should Pay? I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.